We're now at lecture 14 of Standard Model and Beyond. First Beyond the Standard Model lecture. So first lecture of part two, Standard Model and Beyond, now with an emphasis on the beyond. Before anything else, Gong pointed out a mistake at the near the end of the last lecture, which was that when I was writing down all the vertices, I misremembered what the Z coupling to fermions looked like, and I had written that it coupled to left-handers, and that was that was wrong. It has a coupling to both left-handed and right-handed fermions, and to confirm that for yourself, it has a different coupling to left-handed and right-handed fermions, as you would work out when you did the expansion and isolated this term, but to see that there is one, for example, if we looked at the kinetic term for the right-handed guy here, right-handed electron, it would have a coupling to the its charge is -1. It would have a coupling to the hypercharge boson. But then this guy, we had this matrix, Weinberg matrix, relating W3 and B to the Z boson and the photon. And okay, so it's clear that B here will be a linear combination of the Z boson and the photon, and so we'll get both a vertex where fermion-fermion coupled to Z and where fermion-fermion coupled to the photon, even in the right-handed case. Okay, so just wanted to clear that up. Or did anything else? Okay, good. So we're about to plunge into the Beyond the Standard Model part of the course. And so it's a good time to briefly recap what we did so far, just to make sure it's straight in your mind. And if you have any questions about any of the following things, you should still feel free to let me know or raise them either during or after class. But so basically, in very brief, we began by reviewing how Yang-Mills theory works. And we said, basically, to specify a Yang-Mills theory, what you have to tell me is a list of, you have to tell me what's the gauge group of the theory, and then what's the list of all the matter particles, the fermions and scalar fields in the theory, and how they transform, what representations they transform in under the gauge group. So then for the standard model, we did that. That information, the gauge group and the representation, was specified by our beloved table that we wrote down so many times. And then we said, once we've specified that table, you hopefully got comfortable with the fact that by just trying to write down all of the terms that are both space invariant under Poincaré symmetry and under the gauge group and are built from the fields in that table, and if you keep only terms up to dimension 4, you get the Lagrangian for the standard model, and you just write down every term you can and put an arbitrary coefficient in front of them. Okay, and then we messed with this. First thing we did was basically absorb all the unphysical parameters in the model. There's some of these parameters that can be absorbed by field redefinitions and some that can't. So we absorbed away until ended up finding that after absorbing, we had 18 plus 1 physical non-absorbable parameters in the standard model, where this plus 1 is the QCD theta term, which I'll talk about more this lecture. Okay, And these are all parameters that can be measured in experiments and have been measured in experiments, although they haven't all been measured yet to be non-zero. Okay, then the next crucial thing is that we discussed spontaneous symmetry breaking. So first we discussed in general terms spontaneous symmetry breaking for a global symmetry, and the key idea there was Goldstone's theorem about how when you break a global symmetry, you get some massless scalar fields that appear, Goldstone bosons. And the number that you get depends on the size of the group G and the subgroup H, which in turn is determined by the unbroken subgroup H, which is in turn determined by the subgroup of the full set of generators that leave the VEV of the symmetry breaking scalar field invariant. So then we said, and then what happens when instead of breaking a global symmetry, you break a gauge symmetry, is that you instead get the Higgs mechanism. All of these Goldstone bosons get eaten by the corresponding broken symmetry generators of the gauge group, which become massive. Okay, so we have the Higgs mechanism. And so then we spent some time explicitly working that out for the standard model and figuring out exactly how the degrees of freedom represented in this table, where in the table what we write down are the fields separated into irreducible representations of the full unbroken gauge group, we wrote how those are related to the physical propagating degrees of freedom when you do perturbation theory around the vacuum of the standard model. So, you know, we identified the physical degrees of freedom by looking at the quadratic part of this Lagrangian after spontaneous symmetry breaking and working out the formula for all of their masses in terms of the basic parameters of the Lagrangian. Okay, then we met the fact that this Lagrangian by itself does not account for the observed neutrino masses, and so we ended up having to introduce two variants of this Lagrangian. So in addition to L standard model, we had L standard model effective field theory, where we allowed dimension terms of dimension higher than 4, and then we also had L of the neutrino of the new standard model, where we add right-handed neutrinos, but keep the Lagrangian of dimension 4 or less, keep it renormalizable. And we discussed the various merits and demerits and physics of those three models. And then finally, rather hastily at the end, we had so far focused on the, you know, in these bits on the quadratic part of the Lagrangian, and just extracting the physics there was already a relatively fancy story. But, you know, of course, a key thing is the interactions, which all come from the non-quadratic terms in the Lagrangian, and each of those gives rise to a vertex that can be used in the Feynman rules. And so in the last lecture, we explicitly went through and explained, you know, how to see where all of the vertices come from by looking at what non-quadratic terms appear in each of the four lines of the standard model Lagrangian. We didn't have time to explicitly derive the exact coefficient appearing in front of each term. But of course you can look that up in books, but hopefully, you know, I got across how you do it in principle, and enough that you can sort of easily see or quickly re-derive for yourself which vertices are present and allowed. So when you're trying to analyze, you know, if you're trying to think about, oh, is such and such a process, what's such and such particles coming in and such particles coming out, is that even possible in the standard model? And if so, roughly speaking, what's the amplitude for it? You know the basic process of how to go about doing that. Okay, so fine. So where are we now then? So if you want, you know, I began the course by saying that this is what's this all about? This is all about continuing, you know, the effort to first summarize and then continue the greatest puzzle putting together project that humankind has ever been involved in. Okay, so you know, this was the you know, best that I could summarize the current state of the puzzle in terms of in 13 lectures as we currently know it now. You know, if you want, this is the summary of what the part of the puzzle that has been put together looks like. And now we want to see that we want to, you know, begin to focus on, there are some other obvious clues, other puzzle pieces sitting on the table that haven't yet been incorporated into this model. And we want to understand what those are, what the constraints are in terms of how they can or cannot fit. And what are the best options for getting more puzzle pieces, of course. That's another thing we'll cover. But so for starters in this lecture, an important ingredient that I'll need to explain, to begin to talk about these things, are anomalies. Okay, so, you know, I should also just say one thing is that, so, you know, beyond the standard model, physics has been very hard and slow. The standard model famously was essentially in place in the 70s, okay, and although except we've learned a lot more about neutrinos since then, and so learned that this guy is not, this Lagrangian can't be right. Progress, the rate at which new pieces have been introduced into the puzzle since we arrived at the standard model, and the rate at which new pieces have been incorporated into extensions of the puzzle, which you might say is what was going on here and here, has been slow since the 1970s. And well, what can I say? There's various reasons for that. Some have to do with, I would say, Some have to do with real physical constraints and difficulties of doing experiments. Some, I think, have to do with more sociological issues having to do with most of the physics community being preoccupied with topics that in the end maybe turned out to be not right. The bottom line is that, I can't emphasize enough, if you step back, it's the best puzzle there is. It's the most important puzzle that there is. It's the most fundamental. And there's a lot of important puzzles, but there's some sense in which this is among all puzzles that humanity has ever tried to work on. There's something very special about this one. Some people have got to keep working on it. And I will try to convey that I think it's clear that the game is not over, that there is a lot of room and, to my mind, a lot of potential for progress in this puzzle, including in the very near future. So, yeah, I mean, my perspective is that the game is not over, and some people have to keep playing it. So I hope to convince some of you guys to keep playing it. There are easier puzzles where faster progress is possible, and it's good to also, you know, work on those. Definitely people should be working on those too. But by God, somebody's got to be doing this one also. Okay. So, great. So the thing I wanted to talk about today was anomalies. So, now here I'll be quoting, I heard from Gong that to some extent in the QFT course, in the QFT courses, these have been covered. I will be really there's two key results that I just want to quote and then use. They would require too much machinery to devote too much time to derive them in this course. They're more the sort of thing you would derive in a QFT course where you've set up the appropriate formalism. But we're going to need them for analyzing the standard model and its possible extensions and determining which ones are consistent and which ones aren't. I wanted to introduce those now. Okay, so anomalies, you know, so what's an anomaly? Well, so far we've been treating symmetries as transformations. You know, if you have some transformations of the fields in the action that leave the action, you know, so that under phi goes to phi prime, s goes to s of phi prime, which is invariant. You know, in classical physics, that's what a symmetry is. Okay, but in quantum mechanics, you know, the way the action comes into the game is that it's being path integrated. Okay, so you're doing some path integral over all paths relevant to whatever process you're calculating, times weighted by e to the I action, okay, over h bar. And so in order for quantum mechanical processes to be invariant, in order for something to be a symmetry quantum mechanically, it's not enough for the transformation of the fields to leave the action invariant. It also has to leave the measure invariant, because ultimately it's this full integral that is really the thing that is relevant to any quantum mechanical process. Okay, and an anomaly is a symmetry, it's called an anomaly when there's a transformation of the fields that leaves the action invariant. So classically speaking, it's a symmetry, but quantum mechanically, it ends up not being a symmetry because it doesn't leave the measure part of the path integral invariant. Okay, and the most famous example of that sort of anomaly comes from chiral field theories, so theories where there's left and right fermions, and the left and right fermions transform differently under the symmetries. So that's what I want to tell you about. So it's an important thing is to break the anomalies into two types. Okay, there's global and gauge. Okay, here, in other words, you can have a global symmetry of a classical action, a symmetry where the parameter parameterizing the transformation is some parameter alpha that does not depend on space-time. It's just a constant in space-time. Okay, so this sort of symmetry, you know, may turn out to have an anomaly, and that's fine. There's nothing inconsistent about that. That just means that whatever quantity here, that classically, using Noether's theorem, you thought you could derive a conserved quantity from this symmetry, but actually, when you include quantum mechanical effects, that symmetry won't be exactly conserved. Okay, but that's perfectly consistent, and in fact, we'll see in a moment that baryon and lepton number are two symmetries just like that in the standard model. At the level of the standard model, they appear to be their classical symmetries, but then quantum mechanically, they have anomalies. And then on the other hand, there's a gauge symmetries, okay, where the transformation parameter, so here this transformation parameter, you know, is something like phi goes to e to the I alpha phi, and here it's, and the transformation doesn't depend on the space-time coordinate x of the field that's being transformed. Whereas in a gauge symmetry, we have some transformation that's like 5x goes to e to the I alpha of x, 5x. So now in this, for this sort of symmetry, here, if it's anomalous, that's really saying that the theory is inconsistent. And so what we have to make sure is that any theory we look at does not have any anomalies in its gauge symmetries. Okay, so here we would have an inconsistency. So really what we have to do, so what we're going to try to do here is check that the first, go back and check, oh wait a minute, we forgot to check, make sure that the standard model was actually a consistent gauge theory. Are all of its gauge symmetries actually anomaly free? Yes, they will turn out to be. But then it puts an important constraint when we try to speculate about physics beyond the standard model, that any consistent generalization of the standard model should also have anomaly free gauge symmetry. The basic reason is that, you know, unlike this sort of symmetry, this sort of symmetry has a different character. Really what this is saying is that when you have a gauge symmetry, it's really saying that the physical theory is, you're describing it in a way that is redundant. Okay, that the physical degrees of freedom in the theory do not exactly map to the field degrees of freedom that you use to describe it. The fields have more numbers in them than are actual physical observables, and it's redundant. So a certain field configuration and a completely different field configuration can actually specify exactly the same physical state. So it's redundant. I mean, there's nothing, whereas global symmetries, these are the sort of symmetries where you say, oh, I actually take the system and perform an actual honest-to-God physical transformation on it, and then I can't tell that I've done it. So, you know, this is like a sphere up here. If you have a ball here, if it's perfectly spherical, you know, you rotate it, and you can't tell that you've rotated it because it's perfectly spherical. But on the other hand, you know, it's perfectly possible to have a ball with tiny lumps on it, so spherical symmetry is slightly broken. And okay, now you turn it, and it's still approximately true that it looks the same, but not exactly. So fine, that's what global symmetries are like. But gauge symmetries are not like that. I mean, you can't have something that is you can't have a theory that is approximately redundant. I mean, it's either redundant or it's not. You know, if it's exactly symmetric, it's saying that the number of degrees of freedom is less than the number of field components. But if it's not symmetric, then it's not. There's a discontinuous jump in the number of physical field components. There would be if this was anomalous. So we got to rule this out. Okay. Okay, so let's consider the simplest example of a theory with an anomaly. Okay, which is electrodynamics, or the theory of a gauge field coupled to a single right-handed fermion. Okay, so now we're going to be looking at a path integral over, well, the fields in the theory. We have the gauge field, and then we integrate over our right-handed fermion and its corresponding barred field, and we're going to look at e to the I action, where the action here is the integral of the Lagrangian over spacetime, where the Lagrangian is the usual Lagrangian for QED coupled to this right-handed fermion. So we have the kinetic term for the gauge field. And then the kinetic term for the fermion. Okay. So now the result that which I'm not going to derive for you, I'm just going to quote, but if you want to see the derivation, it's done in a couple of pages in section 19.2 of Peskin and Schroeder, is that if we do, the transformation psi right goes to e to the I alpha psi right, okay, where this is a global phase transformation, alpha is a constant, let's imagine. Well, okay, so first of all, classically that's a symmetry of this Lagrangian, because we get an e to the I alpha and an e to the minus I alpha that cancel here. Because it's a global symmetry, it passes right there. What happens to the measure, this part of the measure is not invariant, okay? Instead, it transforms as follows. It picks up an extra factor, which is not quite one, but is instead given by e to the I times the integral of d4x of alpha g squared 32 pi squared over 32 pi squared f mu nu times f mu nu dual. Okay, by the way, I should have said over here, let's imagine really that what I'm about to say is true for an arbitrary Yang-Mills field. So let's let this be, let's not specialize for the case of a U1 gauge field. This is a Yang-Mills field. But so whereas the kinetic term involves F mu nu A and F mu nu A, the term which appears here is F mu nu A times F mu nu A dual, where I remind you that F mu nu A dual is defined by contracting the epsilon tensor, mu nu alpha beta. Okay, this is a Lorentz invariant quantity times f mu nu times f alpha beta a. Okay, so it's important. You know, this thing is different than this thing. This Lagrangian is parity invariant. This one is not. Okay, but so in other words, so if we make this transformation, psi right goes to e to the I alpha psi right, although this part of the Lagrangian remains invariant, if you look at this, it's like we've stuck an additional term into the Lagrangian. So actually, the Lagrangian will change due to this extra term, due to the variation in the measure. It won't go to itself. It'll go to itself plus a change, which is given by delta L equals alpha g squared over 32 pi squared times FF dual. Okay, great. So let's apply that to the standard model and see what we get. Okay, so you know the relevant terms in the standard model. Well, but we don't care. Remember, the standard model has two lines of bosonic terms, and then we have the fermionic kinetic terms. But then in the fourth line, we have a term which is relevant to us, which is the Yukawa couplings. Okay, let me go back to just the ordinary standard model for the moment. So the Yukawa couplings we had were, there was one term that was like Q left couples to h and d right. There was another term that was like q left couples to h twiddle and u right. And there was a third term that was like l left couples to h and e right. Okay, and then you remember that in the one of the early one of the lecture where we first wrote down this Lagrangian, in addition to these 1, 2, 3, 4 lines, we said there was a fifth line, which we've been mostly ignoring since then, but now let's put it back in there. There's a fifth line which we could write down, which is less than or equal to dimension 4 and compatible with both the space-time and gauge symmetries. So by all for all intents and purposes, we should be allowed to put it down. And that is involves parity violating terms for the gauge bosons. So G times G dual, W times W dual, and B times B dual. Okay, so let's write those guys with the following convention now for the coefficients. We'll write the coefficient in front of the GG dual term as some arbitrary parameter, theta 3, the so-called QCD theta parameter, times the QCD coupling constant squared over 32 pi squared, times G mu nu A, G mu nu A, twiddle. So here I've written the coupling constant in a way that of course makes it parallel to the expression that comes out of the anomaly there. Okay, and then there's a corresponding term for that we can write down for SU2. That would look like theta 2 times the G2 coupling constant squared over 32 pi squared WW twiddle. I won't write down the, well, okay, I will. And then finally one for theta, for U1, the theta term for U1, which is theta 1 times G1 squared over 32 pi squared, B mu nu, B mu nu twiddle. Okay, good. So now, recall what the story was. We were trying to soak up all of the unphysical parameters in the theory into field redefinitions. And how far did we get? Well, we managed to make all of these kinetic terms diagonal so that there were essentially no free parameters remaining in this line. And then here we used the singular value decomposition to split the three Yukawa matrices there into V times the diagonal matrix, real diagonal matrix times U. Sorry. And we saw that we could absorb 5 of these 6 Yukawas into field redefinitions. Okay, so we could absorb these two guys into these two fields, and we could absorb these two guys into these two fields, but then we could absorb this guy here, but then we didn't have any more freedom to absorb this guy. And so we ended up with This term ended up getting rewritten like Q left VCKM little y sub D HD right and Q left y sub U H twiddle U right plus L left times little y sub E, the diagonal guy, times H times E right, plus Hermitian conjugate. And okay, so now, what's the point? Why am I going to the trouble of reviewing this? Well, so remember that we had a little bit more freedom here we could, this term was already completely diagonalized, so was this one. Now we asked, well, instead of having an arbitrary unitary matrix of parameters appearing here with 9 free parameters, can we soak up some of those free parameters as being unphysical and soak them into redefinitions of the fields? And we said yes. You know, so we noticed that if we sent QL I, or let's say QLJ to e to the I times alpha j QLJ, and we sent U, we transformed it by the same thing. So ULJ goes to e to the I alpha j ULJ. You know, we want to do a transformation that doesn't mess up this term, because we've already gone to the trouble of diagonalizing it. But this transformation here is okay. That'll leave this term unchanged because it'll introduce the diagonal matrix e to the I alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3 here, but it'll introduce the corresponding matrix e to the minus I alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3 here. And since those are both diagonal matrices, and this is a 3x3 diagonal matrix, this guy commutes right through, cancels this guy, and so nothing happens to that term. So that's the most general transformation of the quarks we can do without screwing up our diagonalization of this term. And then this was supposed to be U, right? And then to D, right, we can transform that by some different phase. Okay. And now when we do this, you know, here we introduce the 3x3 matrix e to the I beta 1, beta 2, beta 3, and here we introduce the matrix e to the minus I alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3. We can commute this diagonal matrix through Y because it's also diagonal, but then we can't commute it through V. Instead, those two diagonal unitaries just hit V from both sides and change it to some new unitary. And so, in other words, we can modify. It looks like we have six real parameters of freedom, alpha 1, 2, 3, and beta 1, 2, 3, of freedom to modify this matrix. And so it looks like we could cut it down from 9 free parameters to 3. But then we notice, oh, wait a minute. If all of these parameters were the same, there's a one parameter subgroup here where alpha j and beta j are all equal and equal to a single constant number alpha. So if they all changed by the same, well, then now the matrix that we introduced here would commute through everything and exactly cancel the other matrix that we introduced over here. And so both of these terms would be invariant. So in other words, this transformation where we let every quark field transform by the same global phase, is a classical symmetry of the Lagrangian, which is nothing but the U1, the symmetry that we called U1 baryon number. Okay, but now let's see if it's anomalous. Well, let's use our formula here for how the Lagrangian changes. So, what change will we get? If we do this transformation in the Lagrangian, which classically looked like a symmetry, once we include quantum mechanical effects and we include that anomalous part, what change to the Lagrangian will we get? Okay, well, here I was looking at a single Yang-Mills field coupled to a single fermion, but we would get another such term for every additional right-handed fermion we had here would introduce exactly the same, another copy of this term, because we would get another copy coming from each, you know, if we had more fermions here, we would have more fermions, more copies of fermions appearing in the measure. We would have d psi right 1, d psi right bar 1, 2, d psi right 1, and d psi bar right 1, and then we would have another term in the measure, d psi right 2, d psi right bar 2. So anyway, we would get a copy for each right-handed guy in the measure. But then a crucial fact is that if we included a left-handed fermion here, then the induced term is comes in but with the opposite sign. Okay? So actually the correction, the anomalous term, crucially, comes with a plus sign for right-handed fermions and a minus sign for left-handed fermions. So, which is why if all we had here was a theory which was not chiral, if all we had here was one right-handed fermion and one left-handed fermion, then this symmetry where we send psi right to e to the I alpha psi right and psi left to e to the I alpha psi left, we would get this term with a plus sign coming from psi right, and we would get the same term with a minus sign coming from psi left, and they would cancel, and that would be an honest-to-God quantum mechanical symmetry of the theory. There would be no anomaly in that case, okay? So then what happens here? Well, we're going to get one term like this coming from each of the different gauge fields, and the coefficient will depend on how many fermions couple to those gauge fields. So let's first look at the contribution from baryon number symmetry to delta L coming from the fields that couple to SU3. Well, in that case, the induced anomaly here will be G mu nu, the SU3 gauge field, times its dual. And it'll have the usual coefficient, alpha times its coupling constant squared over 32 pi squared. But then, what will appear in front? Well, how many different fermions couple? How many different fermions couple to G mu nu? Couple to the SU3 gauge field? Well, there's the only guys are the left-handed lepton doublet. Well, how many of those are there? Well, there's three families, and then each of these lepton doublets is really two fields. So there's six of those, and because they're left-handed, they come with a minus six. But then there's also the right-handed, so this is coming. I'm gonna make myself a little more room here. Okay, so we get a minus six coming from Q left. There's six triplets here that couple to G mu nu, and they're left-handed, which is why we get a minus sign. But then there's also three U rights, three families worth of U rights, so we get a plus three, and three families worth of D rights, so we get a plus three here. So, aha. So actually, this coefficient cancels. We don't get any contribution. We don't get any extra contribution to the GG twiddle term. So, what about the contribution here from WW twiddle? Okay, in that case, the coefficient for each term would be alpha G2 squared over 32 pi squared. And what appears in front? Okay, well, now we're only looking at, again, the only fermions we transformed were those guys. And now, the only terms that will induce an anomaly here are the subset of those transforming fields that actually couple to this gauge boson. And well, in other words, U right and D right don't couple to this gauge boson. So they're not going to contribute to this anomaly. But Q left does. Okay, so how many Q lefts are there? Well, the number of Q left doublets that do transform here is there's three families, and then there's three colors worth of these guys also. And they come with a minus sign because they're left-handed. Okay, so we do get a non-zero contribution here. So in other words, we've already found that this symmetry is anomalous, but let's continue and get the full expression for the change in the action. So finally, we want to calculate the b mu nu twiddle term. So now the overall coefficient is alpha d1 squared over 32 pi squared. And then what appears in front? Well, again, of the fields that are actually transforming non-trivially under the symmetry, we want to look at the subset that couple to B. Okay, let me make myself more room again. I keep not. Okay, well, they all couple to B. They all have non-zero hypercharge. So how much will we get here? Well, first of all, remember what appears as the coefficient in front of each term is the coupling constant squared. And for Yang-Mills, that just is what it is. But remember for the normal convention, including the convention that we use in this class, for a U1 field, the coupling constant that appears in front of B mu is not just G1, but it's G1 times the hypercharge of whatever field we're dealing with. So the effective coupling constant is the hypercharge times G1. So in other words, for every field that contributes to this, what should be appearing here is G1 squared times its hypercharge squared. I've pulled the G1 squared out into this factor, but we still need to remember to put the hypercharge squared over here. Okay, so for Q left, its hypercharge is 1/6 squared. How many of those guys couple to U1? Well, there's three families times three colors, and then it's also a doublet, so there's two components coming from SU2. And then this whole thing comes with a minus sign because they're left-handed. And then, okay, then there's the right-handed quarks. The right-handed up quarks, they come with a factor of their hypercharge squared. And then how many of them are there? There's just three families times three colors. And finally, there's the right, and these guys come with a plus sign because they're right-handed. And finally, the right-handed down quarks also come with a plus sign times their hypercharge minus a third squared. And again, times three families times three colors. So if we simplify this expression, we find that it's, I'll pull a factor of 9 alpha over 32 pi squared out front, just to make it a little bit easier to see what's going on. And then what's left over? Well, here we have, here we just have G2 squared times WW twiddle from that term. Sorry, minus G2 squared times WW twiddle coming from that term. And from this term, okay, after we pull out the 9, what we have here is 2/3 squared plus 1/3 squared is 5/9 or 10/18 minus 1/18. Minus 1/18, because after I pull out this 9, I have 2 times 1/36. So 10/18 minus 9/8 minus 1 is 9/18, which is a half. Okay, so that was all. That may have been too fast to follow in real time, depending on your mental arithmetic speed. But so here we have, in other words, minus a half. We have plus a half times b twiddle. Okay, so that is the anomaly. We've determined that baryon number is anomalous. Okay. So we had already seen previously that it was an accidental symmetry, that if you began to include dimension 5 and higher terms in the Lagrangian, that those terms would begin to violate a baryon number eventually. But now we see something else, that even if you only include the dimension 4 terms, so B is a classical symmetry of the Lagrangian, quantum mechanically it's anomalous. But now if you look at this, you see that actually, as a consequence, by choosing alpha, as we, you know, by varying alpha, by doing this field redefinition, that means that this field redefinition can be used to soak up, So we had these three terms in our Lagrangian. And we're trying to determine, just like we did previously, we tried to soak up all the unphysical parameters. Well, we were able to write down these three guys, but are these three parameters really all non-physical? Well, we've just shown that we can soak up one of those free parameters, either theta 1 or theta 2. Well, no, I should say, we can soak up theta 1. We can soak up theta 2 by a change of variables, by changing the variable, by doing this change of variables, u goes to e to the I alpha u, et cetera. Because now in addition to that term, we get another term that looks just like it, but has a different coefficient alpha. So by choosing alpha appropriately, we can exactly cancel theta 2 there and just remove that term from the Lagrangian. Okay, so the theta 2 term is unphysical, but so far we haven't, since we only have one parameter's worth of freedom, we've only been able to soak up one of those parameters, and in particular, so we can't independently choose, you know, we can only choose alpha to cancel theta 2, but once we've done that, we've fixed alpha. So we can't also, that won't also cancel theta 1. So we're left with theta 1 and theta 3. So let's ask whether we can now cancel those by further transformations. So, just like we had this remaining symmetry in the baryon sector, as we saw before, as we saw in an earlier lecture, we also have an analogous symmetry in the lepton sector that again leaves the Lagrangian invariant. If we took every lepton, L left and E right in this case, and took them all to a constant, E to the I alpha times themselves, L left and E to the I alpha E right. Then that would also be a symmetry of the Lagrangian, because again, we would introduce a diagonal phase matrix here and the conjugate matrix here, and since it's diagonal, can pass right through this diagonal matrix and cancel the other guy. So that would be a symmetry too. That's lepton symmetry. In fact, we said in the lepton case, actually, we could get away with even making a different phase transformation for each generation, as long as we took the same, always took the same alpha here and here. But a little exercise is to show that if you do the exact same calculation I just did, but now with the leptons, you get exactly the same expression, but without the 9. Okay, but the bottom line is, it turns out that you get exactly the same thing in square brackets. So as a consequence, you don't get any more freedom to cancel theta. Thetas here, because ultimately both this transformation and the baryon transformation introduce the same delta L's to the Lagrangian, but with two different coefficients. But those two coefficients, it's their sum, which you can choose to cancel theta 2 here. And then that's all. That's the end of the story. So L is also anomalous. I'll leave that as an exercise to check. It's just exactly the same sort of thing I just did. But doesn't give any more freedom. To soak up parameters. So the two things we take away is that we can eliminate theta 2, but not theta 3 and theta 1. That's the first point. And secondly, it's worth noting that B and L are separately anomalous. Each of them give a change delta L, which is non-zero in the Lagrangian. But because they give changes that are proportional to one another, it means there's a certain combination of B and L that's not anomalous. Okay, so actually, baryon minus lepton number is not anomalous. So that's a global symmetry of the standard model, which is an honest to God symmetry, even quantum mechanically. And I should say, when I say B minus L, in the description I just gave, I used the same parameter alpha here for the baryons and for the leptons. But remember, the more correct thing is what I wrote. At one point, I modified the standard model table to add two extra columns that showed the baryon number charges and lepton number charges for all the different quark and lepton fields. And I added these columns, and I said, baryon number is where you take charge 1/3 for all the baryons and charge 0 for all of the leptons, and then lepton number is where you take 0 for all of the baryons and charge 1 for all of the leptons. So in other words, if you want to see that these two symmetries cancel, you'll find this is a little exercise that again, it's very quick to check and it's worth make sure you understand what's going on, is that if I do that transformation using alpha, what I'm saying is that if I do the corresponding transformation here at the same time I do this transformation but using 3 alpha, 3i alpha and 3i alpha, so that the lepton charges are 3 times as much as the baryon charges, then you'll find that the delta L induced by that transformation is 0. Okay? Yeah?
You said there was a factor 9 in between, like, the baryon has a 9 and lepton has no 9?
Mm-hmm.
Then, okay, so we have one of the 3 that would come from this. We would have one that is 3 times alpha.
Oh, you know, that's a good point. Sorry, let me clarify one thing. Sorry. If you do, so again, really there are 3 separate lepton, there are 3 separate lepton charges. There's the one where you, because in the lepton sector, unlike in the baryon sector, you can transform each generation separately. So if you just transform the first generation of leptons, then there's a factor of 9, because there's 1 factor of 3 coming from the color and 1 factor of 3 coming from the fact that we're only doing 1 family instead of 3.
Okay.
But if you do, yeah, that's a very good point. But if you do lepton, now when I'm talking about, normally when one talks about lepton number symmetry, one means actually where you transform all the leptons at the same time, all 3 families. So you get 3 times that that delta L, and then you need another factor of 3. Okay, we've just done the exercise I was suggesting. Yes, so good, great. So let's see. I just wanted to mention one other. I think in 1 minute I can. No, I'd better leave the gauge anomaly the next time. It's too nice and. It's too nice. I shouldn't rush through it because it's, yeah. I'll stop here. I'll start with the gauge anomalies next time. And then brand unification. Okay.